I didn't mean things shouldn't be memorialized, but I tried to make clear to you something else through that example. It's very difficult not to trivialize something that you want to memorialize. It's very difficult to keep something that you want to, let us say, memorialize from being, as it were, trivialized. That's really the point that is involved in this, and it is that point that I tried to make a last time. And it's the same thing about mass death in First World War. There was a great discussion after the First World War, how can we make memorials to our dead without trivializing them? But eventually it was, of course, trivialized. And eventually battlefield cemeteries became tourist attractions, and people sold what was the equivalent of Coca-Cola or shells or helmets. And you could visit Death Trench for 5 francs and things like that. So in other words, the sacred becomes trivialized. And Pascal in 1660 was already concerned with this problem. And therefore, you have to grasp the totality before you can grasp the individuality, as it were, build up the universe of small steps. If you want to read more about that, there is one wonderful book about that by Robert J. Lifton, Lifton, called The Broken Connection, which is a book actually about death, but also about Hiroshima in that connection, and about the numbing process about which I talked, which is another way to sublimate catastrophe, and if you read Robert Lifton. Now, while I'm on books, there's only one more I want to recommend to you to what I come now. The background, of course, for Robert Pierre Bayle, to whom I come today, I can't give you, properly speaking, because we're not concerned with that. But if you want to read more on that, there's a very good book you can get in paperback by Richard Popkin called The History of Skepticism. And that is really from Erasmus to Spinoza. And this history of skepticism from Erasmus to Spinoza, though it does not touch quite what we are going to touch, is the necessary background. Because what happens now is that, contrary to Pascal, who still believed that the universe could be explained by faith, that you could face ultimate problems, the universe, because you are a feeble reed. You are a drop in the universe. A flower pot on your skull can kill you. Though all this is true, still man can have a sense of the universe through Christianity. Christ made it possible through his salvation for man to have a sense of the universe, though he cannot grasp it with his reason. Still, Christ made possible faith. Faith makes possible a possibility. And so Pascal's famous wager, which I talked about, that religion is an uncertainty, that there is nothing certain about religion. This kind of religion is nihilism. This trend, which was not going to succeed, but which you can follow through history. Religion is revolutionary. Religion is nihilism. Religion is uncertainty. All the opposite things that you think of as religion today, unfortunately, in a way. Religion is an uncertainty. For Pascal, this was all manageable. You could cope with it because it was still a possibility. And the possibility was through the leap of faith. But with Pascal's Critical Dictionary of 1697, that leap of faith is really no longer there. And you get in Pascal, as I said last time, really an arsenal of arguments which the Enlightenment used against Christianity. So that despite of what Pascal says about revelation, which we shall see a little later, Pascal is really the first great anti-Christian tract. And this for a reason. Now, there have always been people who have stressed doubt. But the Christian way of stressing doubt is the way of Erasmus in the 16th century. doubt as suspending judgment. The Christian way ought to integrate the idea of doubting into Christianity was simply to, in a way, suspend judgment. You suspend judgment. That didn't touch faith. That didn't touch the ultimate. That was Erasmus's way to suspend judgment. But Bale goes one step further. After the discoveries of astronomy, the unsettling of the chain of being, which I talked about, after the discoveries of science, he goes further. He doesn't merely suspend judgment, but he pushes doubt to its ultimate. And how does he push doubts to its ultimate? Through doing something very modern, through asking questions. Through asking questions, through simply asking questions and raising things by asking questions, he pushes doubt to its ultimate extent. He doesn't simply suspend judgment. He doesn't simply say, we can't judge this. So let's just not talk about it. Let's forget about it. Let's suspend it. He, as you will see, asks questions. And there are questions which go to the essence of things, if you like, the essence of things. He pushes Pascal's wager to making life a total wager by asking questions. And through these questions, showing up, if you want to put it, Christianity, showing up faith. Showing up, at least he meant to, show up faith, show Christianity. And so what he is really doing, and that's very important for us, through this asking questions, he is preparing the critical mind of the Enlightenment. Now, I told you the Enlightenment of the 18th century was central, because central to it was something that had never been central before to the image of man, since Socrates. And I shall come back to the affinity later, but had never really been central, the critical mind. The critical mind. It cannot be central in a Christian universe, because faith conflicts with the critical mind, obviously. And we shall see later whether this can really be carried through, but that's not my problem now. So let us look with these things at Pascal. Let us look at Pascal. And let us look at his question. The first question he asks is a very simple one. His questions are rather simple. He says, what about then the universe? The universe is a work of God, you say. And then he makes the following comment. How can it come to pass in that case that if the universe is a work of God, that the human race should be attracted towards evil by an almost irresistible allurement, I mean by the sensation of pleasure, and should be steered away from it by the fear of remorse or by that of infamy and several other punishments, and that mankind should spend their whole lives in this conflict of passions, pulled sometimes one way and sometimes the other, sometimes conquered by pleasure, and sometimes by the fear of its consequences. Now, if that's God's universe, how come, therefore, that men really have two things which God shouldn't really allow? First, man is a creature of passion. That's really what he's saying. And passion is bad. I've told you that already. We'll come into it when we see the rise of modern respectability and bourgeois morals. For the bourgeois, passion is bad. After all, I'm not telling you anything you don't know. Your parents always have told you, I'm sure. You all had parents. That's the one thing about you that's certain. The only thing, as far as I know. But the other thing that's certain is they've told you to be moderate. Don't be so immoderate. Hey, haven't they told you that? Be moderate. Which meant, of course, eventually be respectable. Have your hair cut and, you know, do the right thing and all that sort of thing, yes? Be normal, don't be abnormal. Well, abnormality is, of course, a very large category we shall come to. So be moderate. But Bale's idea is simply other. If moderation is the essence of the universe, harmony. You see, before that, whenever you look at Christianity, Luther, Calvin, Catholicism, I don't care what you look, the sects, the Quakers, whatever, the universe is a harmonious universe. We shall come back to that. Harmony is of the essence, because people can't cope with affinity. They need harmony. I come again to this sort of thing, you know. Why are cemeteries constructed the way you are? You never have asked yourself the questions. You don't ever ask yourself any question, do you? You go past life and you just take it for granted. That's dreadful. When you see a cemetery or anything else, you've got to ask yourself, why is it constructed? Why are all cemeteries alike? Now, you never asked yourself that. And the reason is, of course, the idea of harmony and order. It enables people to cope with catastrophe. You've got to make order out of it. Otherwise, you can't cope with it. You can't cope with it. So you have ordered paths and ordered graves and all that sort of stuff. Nothing disordered. So, because you can't cope with disorder. So harmony is the essence for Luther, for Calvin, for the Christian universe, not only for the Christian universe, for any universe, even for early astronomy, for Newton, for anybody. And when Newton found there was no harmony, he appeared to God to harmonize the sunspots. So you always have harmony, moderation. And Pascal says here, how come that that's really not true? Man is a man of passion. He's buffeted between pleasure and remorse. So, first question. Yes. No, Bale. We're now with Bale. If you just, your question shows you haven't understood anything I've said. So either you ask Barry or me about it after class, or you give up. So anyway, we're finished. Bale says that. Pascal couldn't say that. Pascal could say that, but he would add immediately he would add, that this is because you're perceiving the universe with reason. You're pushing your reason too far. This is all very true, but you can explain it by the leap of faith, by grasping the totality. You're pushing your reason too far. That's what Pascal would have said. But Bale leaves it here. So again, it's a question. Clear? Now, the next question, let us go one step further here. For God can do whatever he pleases. If God is infinite, God can do whatever he damn pleases. He is able to remove evil, but is not willing to do so. So why? That questions, of course, the existence of God. God can do anything. If God can do anything, why doesn't he just remove evil? Save us all the tzoras, as we say, all the difficulties, yeah? I mean, after all, you know, why doesn't he do that, yes? Why doesn't he do that, yes? For example, I have a problem at the moment. I have bad nerve endings. They give signals of pain when there is no pain. So I can appeal like Newton to God to end it, but he doesn't choose to end it. So why? 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 So that's really what he's adding. Now, all this seemed to you not very profound questions, because since Bale and since the Enlightenment and since Christianity lost its monopoly, these are questions everybody's asked. But Bale was the first and the breakthrough, as you were. Today, and this brings me back to what I said at the beginning of the course, these are questions that seem to you normal. Yes? So not to theologians. One of the reasons that Jewish theology is never kept with Auschwitz is because there is really no explanation possible. Why should God have allowed it? This cannot be faced, a very difficult problem. So what you have really here is questions which may seem to you banal, but which in 1697 were far from that. Finally, and most profoundly, and that is really the most profound a problem which he raises, is what I might call very simply, or I'll give you his question. What is strange is that Christians, whose system of religion is so pure, yield almost nothing to the Gentiles in respect of engaging in vices. It is a mistake to believe that the moral practice of a religion corresponds to the doctrines of its confession of faith. That is, why do Christians engage in more vices than the Gentile? What does it do to Christianity? You know, what is its effectiveness? Now, what Bale is doing here is very simple but very central for everything that's going to follow. He divorces faith from virtue. Now, that's a very unchristian thing to do. Nobody before Baal really divorced faith from virtue. And you can say that a lot of our modern problems will come from this divorce of faith from virtue. If faith and virtue are no longer the same, if the faithful are virtuous, or to put it with my favorite personal saying, that it rains on the righteous and unrighteous alike, but the unrighteous always have the umbrellas. If this is true, what does that mean? That's a very modern thing, you see. If I'd lived in the 17th century, I wouldn't have said it. And if I'd said it, I would have been burnt or something, so it wouldn't have been very good, you know. But today you laugh. You've already, the divorce between faith and virtue is almost total already. Now, what is the consequence? And I must give you again the consequence of this. The consequence of this is that people want somehow to integrate virtue. It must be integrated with something. Because in a sense, bourgeois society, modern society, depends on the definition of virtue. It depends on it. You mustn't confuse virtue and vice. Modern society, in the speed of time, depends on not confusing things. It depends on clear distinction. And these clear distinctions is normal and abnormal. You cannot confuse virtue and vice. And that is one of the reasons, by the way, somebody asked me, why we are now coming to an age in a way of the, if you like, of less sexual tolerance. For the sex roles of men and women must be clearly defined now. You cannot confuse them, because that is one thing you hold on to. You cannot have men acting like women and women acting like men. You cannot confuse sex roles. You cannot confuse normalcy and abnormalcy, because you no longer have an integrated universe. You somehow have to integrate virtue. You see what I'm saying? And so the distinction itself becomes important. The distinction itself becomes important, not just what it is integrated to, because the universe of faith is lost. And so you have to substitute. And what you will substitute eventually is, if you like, distinctions almost for their own sake. This clear distinctions for their own sake, eventually it'll be annexed by nationalism, eventually be annexed by liberalism, by all sorts of secular ideologies. But the transition, let me put it this way, the transition from virtue as a matter of Christianity to virtue as something integrated in a merely secular ideology, though if it was nationalism, it presented itself as a new religion, means a clinging to distinctions as a security blanket in a very chaotic world, in a world of railways, a world of macadamized roads, the world of mobility, the world anything. So that the distinctions that we again take for granted of normal and abnormal, sexuality, men and women, totally different roles, all of these things are part of this whole picture of the quest for clarity, the quest for clear distinction, with the beginning of doubt rather than the Christian universe. Well, all this was not so important because, in a way, you had faith. You had faith. You did not have to cling to secular distinction. It was not so important that you had your hair cut then. It's very important now. It's a distinction people cling to. Now, I hope I have made myself clear. And all of this, you see, all of these questions attack religion and they attack Pascal. For as Pierre Bayl says, for example, and you may say this is an attack on Pascal and Pascal's idea, religion ought to be based on certainty. Its aim, its effect, its uses is collapse as soon as the firm conviction of its truths are erased from the mind. So what he really says is Bayl's attack is in a way so profound, I mean, from a religious point, so vicious. Because he says, all right, you say religion is based on a truth, But in reality, how can it be based on a truth? If there are some questions we ask, fairly obvious questions, and the answer is that it's really open to doubt. If Christianity is a religion of virtue, why are Christians full of vice? Just as much vice as a Gentile. So why not be a Gentile to begin with? You see. If Christianity gives you certainty and moderation, if it gives you a harmonious universe, why are all you creatures of passion buffeted between pleasure and remorse? You might think about that this weekend. In our society, weekends are always more temptation. I don't know why. That's also, you see, clear distinctions. You have to go out on Friday night. Why can't you go out on Tuesday night? You never think about that. You never think about it. Everything is history. Everything has a historical origin. Everything, everything. There's nothing that doesn't have a historical origin. And you always go past it. You never ask it. You just take things for granted. Why? Because you do want security. You want your safety blanket. But historians like me are to destroy that security. That's my task. To destroy your myths, to strip you naked. See whether we succeed. When I still gave freshman courses, I used to start them by saying, the success of this course will be seen by the suicides at the end of it. See? So and I meant that quite seriously, you see, because, I mean, you're already more mature, but I have to destroy your world. That's my point. Yes? So, in other words, you have here, therefore, then, this idea. The world, therefore, for Bale, what can it be but a world of chance? A world of chance, in a way, yes? That's all that can be, really. A world on such doubt, what is it? It is a world of chance. It is a world that destroys myth. A world of chance. The beautiful order that reigns in nature. Led man to believe that nature is directed by the very wise laws of an infinite God. But this order reigns among men, the prosperity of the wicked, the unhappiness of the virtuous. So in other words, all right, so maybe nature is regulated by God. But that still doesn't affect men, because it is the vicious that are happy and the virtuous that are unhappy. So what you have here then is, what else can there be really than chance? Now you say there can be reason, but Bale not only attacks religion, he also attacks reason, which is the other possibility, the possibility that Pascal, after all, had left. Reason. Human reason is too feeble. It is a principle of destruction and not edification. It is only proper for raising doubts. In other words, if reason is only proper for raising doubts, if it doesn't settle or anything, then there is again no way out here, nothing firm for you to hold on to, no safety blanket, nothing at all. What is left? What is left? And here, Pierre Bayle makes his famous statement about the atheist. What is left is the atheist. That is what is left. What does Bayle say about it? There are irreligious people who may be more strongly impelled towards a virtuous life by the springs of temperament accompanied by the love of praise and sustained by the fear of dishonor, then others are impelled by the dictate of conscience. Please note carefully that in speaking of the good morals of some atheists, I have not attributed any real virtue to them. Their sobriety, their chastity, notice the irony in this, their sobriety, their chastity, their probity, their contempt for riches, their zeal for the public good, their inclination to be helpful to the neighbor, were not effects of the love of God, and neither tended to honor nor to glorify him. They themselves were the source and end of all this, self-love was the boundary and the cause of it. In other words, virtue is based on self-love. It's not based on God. It's based on self-love. It's based on praise, and the fear of dishonor, and not on conscience. Now, that is a deep attack on Christianity, because if virtue is due on self-love, it's due the chief Christian sin. Let me remind you, I'm sorry, remind is absurd, because you never knew, of course. Because all you do in your Sunday school, if you were, is you sing nice songs. You never learn a damn thing, as far as I can tell, unfortunately. So the chief Christian sin is the sin of pride. Always has been. And the sin of pride is the sin of self-love. But Bill says the chief Christian sin is the basis of all virtue. Now, that's clear. If that is so, the chief Christian sin, a basis of all virtue. What is there but man himself? What is left but man's temperament? Man himself, human society, the love of praise, the love of dishonor, that is what does you good. So that has nothing to do. Now, however, Bale needed a cover. You couldn't really say all the things that I have said in 1697. You would be put before an ecclesiastical tribunal in France. You couldn't say it. And so Bale, in the very end, goes back to Revelation, believe it or not. In the end, he goes back to Revelation, or rather, he has this cover at the beginning of his dictionary, as a matter of fact, just to safeguard himself. He says, the light of philosophy can only guide a man to the point where he will admit that he knows nothing, and because that is so, we must go to Revelation. But Revelation here doesn't mean a thing. It's not Pascal's revelation. You can't grasp the universe for Revelation. Revelation is his fig leaf. Revelation he puts in so he doesn't get translated before a tribunal. So he makes it a good Christian book. All anti-Christian books will be in disguise of Christian books so as you don't come foul of the law. That's clear. And that is why this attack on Christianity, which will foreshadow all others of the Enlightenment, this attack of Christianity isn't an outright attack. It is questions, raising questions. And then, if you like, giving answers and pushing doubt to its furthest extent, making, if you like, in a way, a Christianity meaningless in this degree, making it meaningless and doing, above all, then, this tearing apart of faith and virtue. Faith and virtue torn apart. Now, all of this said, there are two questions which arise, which bring us directly to the Enlightenment. First of all, is it possible to construct a new man on this principle? A new man who is autonomous. That's really what it comes to. An autonomous man. A man who is autonomous, who has a critical mind, who depends only on his critical mind and nothing outside himself. Is that at all possible? That is one of the basic questions of the 18th century Enlightenment. Is it at all possible? That's they wanted. They wanted the new man. Now, you're reading about the new man in two ways. You're reading Nathan the Wise, and Nathan is the new man of the Enlightenment. Let's see what you think of Nathan, yes? Some of you said you love Nathan the Wise. I think Nathan is a crashing bore. But then that's my idea, because virtuous people, you know, are, you know. A Jesuit said the right thing about them. Who else but a Jesuit would say it? Good people can never leave well enough alone. I think that's, you know? I think that's the best thing ever said about good people. Anyway, you make up your own mind what you think of Nathan. Nathan is the product of the new man. That's the new man, Nathan. And Emile, whom you read by Rousseau, that's the new man in the making. For what the Enlightenment wanted, really, was a new man. the first of a long quest for new men. From now on, all secular ideologies want a new man. Nationalism was a new man, the new German, the new Jew, the new Frenchman, the new Slovenian, I don't know what, but you can be sure of something, that by the 19th century there will be the quest for the new man, and that new man will solve all problems. That's an Enlightenment idea. The new man, through his critical mind, will solve all problems and eventually becomes the Aryan, the German stereotype, the new Jew, the new whatever you want to. The new man who will solve all problems. The new communist, the new Bolshevik man. I don't mind what. Anyhow, it's the first of a long quest, and it's part of the result of doubting. It's part of the quest to get out of the bind. You no longer have a Christian universe. So you have the autonomy of man. But after all, man today doesn't match much hope. So you are autonomous. You'd still lead us to perdition, I'm afraid. So what are you going to do? You're going to breed a new man who will lead us to salvation. People always have a need for a messiah of some kind, especially in a world that's chaos. So you try to breed a new man. So what you're doing is the first of all sorts of things. I mean, it's true all the time. I remember right after the Second World War, when you went to a communist country, you were always shown kindergartens. I hate children, and I hate kindergartens, believe me. But you had to go from one kindergarten to another, because these were the new men being bred. Well, they haven't amounted to a hill of beans, and they never do. But it's always the idea, the autonomy of man. And the beginning of that is Émile, Rousseau's Émile. And the beginning, the result of that, is Nathan. From this to the worship of children, the worship of these damn kindergartens. You've got to, yeah? So what you have is a new man. I have a theory, all babies look like Mussolini anyhow, so why try? You see. So, but I hope I make myself clear. I hope I make myself clear to you anyway. Now, however that might be, what you have, therefore, is the quest towards the new man, the quest to the new man, the first of a long quest based on the autonomy of the mind, autonomy of doubt. Now, that's the first thing that comes out of it. But the second question is just as important, and for us, more important in the end. Namely, it still needs an authority. Even that needed authorities. That even the Enlightenment couldn't get away from authority. Nobody could get away from authority, except the authorities were different authorities than the authorities of Pascal of the Christian universe. For the Enlightenment has a dialectic which I have now made clear, I hope, through Pascal and through Bayle, a dialectic. That on the one hand, it quests for an autonomous man, the critical mind. Man, in a way, his own God, if you want to put it that way. And on the other hand, it reached out for authorities. What are the authorities the Enlightenment will reach out to? There are three authorities the Enlightenment will reach out to, which must concern us. The natural law, the examples of the ancients, especially Greece, but also Rome. Natural law, the ancients, and history. And therefore, you get this dialectic between the search for autonomy and the need for authority. No longer the authority of Christ and revelation. Finally, this is, of course, and I want to make that clear again, a matter for intellectuals. The idea of the autonomy of man, the Bayle, the idea of doubt, made the Enlightenment stress education, reason, doubt. Doubt based on reason, stress education. And so that in the end, the ideals of the Enlightenment become the ideals of intellectuals. And Voltaire will put it very nicely, as he always puts things very nicely, there is a difference between Newton and a mule, which meant there is a difference between educated people and non-educated people. Yes? There is a difference between Newton and a mule. So that we can say that the universe to which we now come, this quest between the dialectic of the critical mind and authority, that quest, yes, that quest will influence intellectuals, the upper middle classes. And only in one nation which was born in the Enlightenment will it go deeper, in the United States. The United States was born out of the ideas of the Enlightenment. Only there will it become a part of popular culture and popular discussion. Because anything I have said about the dialectic, think about your own life and the own cultural atmosphere still today. You can say that in the United States today, as a result of the Enlightenment, which of course in Europe, in other words, was defeated by nationalism, by and large, by nationalism. As a result of the Enlightenment, you still have this conflict in a way, a rhetoric of the autonomy of man, or reaching out for the autonomy of man, the critical mind, an individualism. But at the same time, you have a reaching for authority, a questing for authority, a reaching to be integrated with some authority. And the authorities have remained the same. Natural law, after all, since our last election, our economy is supposed to function according to natural law. No, I'm not kidding you. This is Adam Smith. We are now, it's an Enlightenment. We are going back to an Enlightenment economics, to the economics which comes out of this. Natural law regulates economics. And reaching out for a historical tradition, obviously, our so-called forefathers, which is reaching out for myth. Because your forefathers were perhaps in Scotland, in England, or in Polish ghettos, or in Germany, but they had nothing to do with George Washington whatsoever. obviously that's myth. All nationalism is based on myth, yes? Our forefathers were never what nationalism says they were, never. That's myth. So reaching out for myth, to put it a little more sophisticatedly, reaching out for myth, a myth which you can integrate, yeah? Your forefathers, your ancestors. All of this, together with the power of man's reason. And let me put the dialectic one little bit differently. There is in the Enlightenment, since Bayle and Pascal, and they're very relevant to that, a conflict between what reason is supposed to do and the reality of reason. In other words, the rejection of Pascal and the attempt, which you will see in Nathan the Wise, I'll come to that on Monday, in Nathan the Wise, to extend reason, and on the other hand, to reach out for some kind of authority. Because the idea was clear, and it's been clear always, that you need an authority. For ever since the beginning, reason itself, the concept of reason, the concept of the autonomy of man, has been based on the presupposition of a harmonious universe. Because from the beginning, even those who, like Bayle, believed that man was autonomous, that man's ideas were autonomous, had to make a presupposition. And the presupposition was a harmonious universe. Because otherwise everybody's reason would be different and you would live in complete chaos. There has to be a common denominator. That's very clear in Nathan the Wise. Very clear in Nathan the Wise. There has to be a common denominator. Because if there wasn't a common denominator between Nathan and the Sultan and all the good people, there would be chaos. And there cannot be chaos. So there must be some kind of common denominator. So even those like Bayle and others, Bayle perhaps not, but the rest who believed in the autonomy of man and man is God, had to make a presupposition of harmonious universe because it wouldn't work otherwise. And the basis of this presupposition again goes back to the 17th century, to the man who really gave them their ideas on this subject, Descartes, who believed that everybody can have clear and distinct ideas. That these clear and distinct ideas are so clear and distinct that they can be mathematically formulated. And that these ideas are always the same because you can't change formulas of geometry. So if you and I, or you and I, have clear and distinct ideas, they will be the same clear and distinct ideas, right? The claim. And Descartes had to go back to God. These are why, because the question is, why are they clear and distinct? And there was no other way of answering and saying, God speaks to us through clear and distinct ideas. And they're always the same. And here you see another dialectic of the Enlightenment we must come to, that on the one hand, it is a great liberating movement. On the other hand, it is a new tyranny. And now you can say, why in the Enlightenment two things start? The idea of individual freedom and racism are both come from the Enlightenment. On the one hand, the idea of individual freedom and the autonomy of man. And on the other hand, that people must be alike. They must have the same clear and distinct ideas. And that is, again, the grasping for distinctions, the grasping for a security blanket. You cannot live in chaos. And you're always under necessity. And when you read Nathan, please, and when you read Rousseau's Emile, remember that. You're always under the necessity to explain why. If man is autonomous, can you avoid chaos? How can you avoid chaos? How can you avoid what Bale says, man is a creature of passion? Now all of this has brought us to the threshold of the Enlightenment. And what we are going to do, practically speaking, we are going to discuss the Enlightenment now in three stages. First, I will discuss the new man. To spend all my life discussing new men. New man. The new man. And then on Wednesday, Professor Fishman will come in here and discuss the making of the new man. That is, of course, Emile, how the new man is made. Because the new man must be made. He must be quite new. That's the trick about it. You are already too old to be new men. You're old. Finished. So anyway, the new man, secondly. And thirdly, we must discuss the new authorities to which they in fact did reach out. Now we can't separate it so neatly, because when I discuss the new man, I already have to discuss the natural law. Because from the beginning, the new man wasn't that new at all. On the one hand, he was autonomous. On the other hand, there had to be a harmonious universe. And it's quite clear in Nathan, that harmonious universe is based on the natural law. I just want you to reread one thing of the weekend, which will tell it all, that dialogue between Nathan himself and the governess, Daya, the governess, yes? And in that dialogue, Nathan says, you mustn't dream, you mustn't fantasize, yes? You mustn't dream because everything is cause and effect. There you have it all. The universe is based on a clear distinction of cause and effect. In other words, it is harmonious. It is harmonious. It is cause and effect. You must not dream. Dreaming is dangerous. Dreaming is superstitious. And there you already have the beginning of a harmonious universe based on natural law, because cause and effect are clear and distinct ideas. Clear and distinct ideas. And they come in the end from God. They come to God. So we return to God. But we return to God in a much different way than Pascal. That must be clear. We return to God in a quite different way. For what is rejected really in all of this? What is the bottom line? What is rejected is what we call revealed religion. Revealed religion, and if you like, what is rejected is any idea of Christ. That is, any idea that religion is revealed, but also a revealed God. A personal God who speaks to you through the burning bush, Christ as your personal Savior who speaks to you, prayer as a personal experience between you and God, as a dialogue between you and God. That is rejected. And instead we get into something, and I always come back to that, because it's kind of the thread that holds this together. We come to that in an ever more impersonal universe. Impersonal. Natural laws, ancients, history, impersonal authorities. And the personality of man is supposed to substitute for impersonal authority. But he doesn't. It couldn't be done. And therefore, the ever more grasping at clear distinctions, the ever more grasping at eventually respectabilities, outward signs, as you will see, of inward grace, as I call it, outward signs, ideas of outward beauty, all of this sort of thing, ever more grasping at that, because in fact it didn't work to make man autonomous. To substitute man as his own personalization for the personalization of God and Christ. And what you end up with, if you like, are new myths and new symbols. But you still end up with myths and symbols, but in an ever more impersonalized universe. Because the new authorities, these were general impersonalized authorities. That must be clear. Now, all of what I've said, the problems I have raised, and I must end with this today because I can't say that too often, are problems which are not solved. They are problems that are open problems, because in a sense they are problems that concern you as much today as they did Pascal or Voltaire or Lessing, Nathan the Wise, or Rousseau. These are all problems. Which will recur, because the modern age has a lot of similarities throughout it. And the basic thing of the modern age, the speed up of time, that is constant. And therefore, if it is a hang-up for the 18th century, where they thought the macadamization of roads was a big thing, and the 19th century, where they thought that railway travel led to the end of nerves and degeneration, then for the 20th century with the airports, which really do lead to the degeneration of nerves, and I think myself. So anyway, this is still a problem. These problems are all relative, but it is a problem for modern times, together with the discovery of science, as I've told you before, and as it were, the loss of Christian monopoly. And that's, of course, the bottom line again. The loss of the monopoly of Christianity. Now, we'll come to the Enlightenment, but let me say at the next week, but let me say at the end again, if you have any question, I do wish you would raise your hand. This is an intimate enough class. I think you can do it, yes? So don't just stare at me uncomprehendingly, because I can't do anything about that, you know. Nothing at all.